This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. Earlier this month, Darren Wong announced that he was resigning as executive director of the AJC Decatur Book Festival. Wong co-founded the annual event, which is heading into its 12th year this Labor Day weekend. As he leaves, he will also be launching a book at the festival, his debut novel. He joined us in our studios to talk about this change in direction. Darren Wong, I remember about, 13 years ago, you told me Decatur is the new Brooklyn. And I laughed. And now I think, wow, you really should have taken out a copyright on that, because
now Brooklyn is the old Decatur.
There you go. Brooklyn, the literary epicenter of the United States, and the comparison to Decatur, you founded the AJC Decatur Book Festival.
With help.
And now you have come to the decision to move on. What made you decide to resign as executive director?
It feels like a good break in my life. I've got a novel coming out, and there's just a shift in mindset. And the difference between founding a festival and running a festival is considerable, I think it's time for, I really do feel like it's time for new leadership at the festival. There's great people in place. There's great people working on the festival every day.
What do you think that leadership will look like going forward?
Here's what I hope it it will include, and I've got a great board, and I'm sure that they understand this as much as anybody, that what needs to happen with the festival is kind of a continued emphasis on kind of collaboration and an overused term, but community as well. The reason the festival works as well as it does is because there is so much buy-in, I think, all around Decatur and in the writing community. And Julie Wilson, who is the program director for the festival, she doesn't have a long background in books or anything. She has a passion for it, but she has a really intelligent mind and a great curiosity, and she's smart enough to listen to all the expertise she has at hand, and she has no problem calling up people and saying, what about this author? What about that author? Who would round this out? That kind of, there's so many smart people in Atlanta, and the way the festival should run is to tap into that, to empower what we have here.
It's undeniable that the festival has had an impact on the culture and commerce of the city of Decatur. How has that impacted you?
Well, I've had a gig for 12 years, which is nice. But it is hard to. It's really hard to kind of quantify what it means to run the Decatur Book Festival for 12 years, to have been kind of welcomed into the city of Decatur in that way. There's the sense of belonging that comes from it, and being part of what is a really special place. More than anything, that's what it means to me, I think.
What are you looking forward to doing next Labor Day, Darren?
Are you kidding? I get to go to all the sessions. I get to go to the parties. Somebody says something's going wrong, I go get another drink. I don't care. What could be better?
Well, here is wishing you congratulations on launching this very exciting event
that's
now a part of you know, the creative community's DNA here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a great trip. It's been a lot of fun.
After a break, Darren Wong will talk about his debut novel, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. You're listening to City Lights on WABE.
Support for WABE comes from Live Nation, welcoming El Devo to Chastain Park Amphitheater this Saturday night. Tickets are on sale now at livenation.com. That's international vocal group El Devo live in concert for one night only. The Atlanta Board of Education welcomes input from students, parents, staff, and the community. The next community meeting is Tuesday, September 5th at 6 p.m. in the Atlanta Public School Center for Learning and Leadership Auditorium, 130 Trinity Avenue, Southwest Atlanta. Sign-in is from 5 to 5:50 p.m. Atlanta Public Schools, with a caring culture of trust and collaboration, every student will graduate ready for college and career.
This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. After running the largest independent literary festival in the South for over a decade, one would think writing a book would be a natural step. Yet, Darren Wong spent years trying to give his story away. Luckily for us, no one took him up on it. And his story of the Civil War, the Underground Railroad, and a small town in upstate New York is being launched this weekend. Wong joined us in our studios to talk about The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. This is your debut novel. Tell us how you decided on the story.
The story kind of wouldn't leave me alone. I grew up in this place. It's upstate New York, 15 miles from the Canadian border, outside of Buffalo. And Town Line, New York, even as a little boy, I'd hear these stories that it seceded from the Union.
Was it the only northern city to secede?
The only place north of the Mason-Dixon. So I heard those stories, and I also heard the story that the house that my parents owned, that we rented out, that was in front of the barn that I grew up in, and that does explain my manners. I grew up in a barn. The front house that we owned, you'd go into the cellar, and there was a hidey hole dug into the wall of the cellar, and there's a huge brass bell hanging in a belfry over the roof, and none of this makes sense, you know. But this is, if you know, you're a 6-year-old boy, you're this is where you live. This is just the way things are. And you know, as I grew older and came south and started to understand the history of place, did I really start diving into this story? And it just got stranger and stranger.
Well, certainly it must have felt like a certain vindication that the house you were living in was formerly a stop on the Underground Railroad, when, in fact, the town you were living in was the only northern city to secede.
Yeah, you say city, you have to think, I mean, the vote was 80 to 23 to secede. This is not
a little town.
But it's yeah, the contradiction of those two things. This old house in the middle of the town, the hamlet, running an underground railroad station, and the town seceding. You know, that was always conflated in my memory, but only, you know, once I started researching it, and what happened was I found an oral history of the Willis family that had built this house and built the farm, and I'd never heard the name Willis growing up in this place. There's plenty of other names memorialized on streets and stuff in Town Line, New York, but the Willis family that founded the town is not mentioned anywhere.
Strange.
Yeah. So it leads to this idea of the alienation between the founder and the place, And that was really, that was interesting to me. And it also, you know, I grew up, I'm half Chinese, and, you know, growing up in this place that if you pull up the demographics of Alden, New York, or Townline, New York right now, which is it is still 99% white. You know, it's a small rural farming town. There's not, you know, there's not a lot of moving back and forth. And so I understood that alienation, you know, that kind of separation from place.
You had the oral history then, and you did some research on your own. I read that you tried pitching the story to other authors.
Well, yeah, you have. So the story focuses on Mary Willis, right? This woman who graduates from Alfred University, 1858, and it was only the second school in the country to accept women. Oberlin was the first, Alfred was the second, right? And so she's radical. This is a radical choice to go to college in 1856, 1857. She graduates 1858, and she comes home to start running an underground railroad station. And it's wild. I mean, she's an abolitionist. She's a radical feminist, and I'm thinking, you know, in the middle of this very odd town in the other direction. But and then I start researching the greater area, and Western New York. There's an argument to be made that Western New York was the most radical place in the world in the first half of the 19th century. So Frederick Douglass is operating in Rochester, the root of abolitionism, essentially, right? The meeting for where feminism starts with Elizabeth Cady Stanton is over in Seneca Falls. There's a large collection of literature around radical religions that start in Western New York. Of course, Mormonism starts in Western New York outside of Rochester. Spiritualism starts in our backyard. I found the border of our backyard was across the creek, was owned by a group called the Ebenezers, the Community of True Inspiration, that was a essentially at that point was a communist cult, where the children were, a child was born, it was raised in commune, and all the men, when it came time for harvest, all the men would line up on one side of the field and beat in rhythm and harvest the field at one time. And I knew none of this. I knew none of this growing up there. And you start finding these stories, and you start pulling these threads, and you say, I mean, a woman that was living there, both would feel really isolated, but would also feel really engaged or be yearning to be engaged.
So you couldn't get any writers to bite.
No. You can only write the book that you're called to, right? You can't. Nobody can. You can't. You never take the book that somebody else pitches to you.
Darren, the research must have been extensive. I mean, when did you feel like you had enough background to begin the novel?
You know, I could have just kept going. I could still keep going. I still pull, you know, every time I something comes up, I'll go down another rabbit hole. You know, I think the moment that kind of, what was kind of transformative for me is I'd sat down and started writing, and I had a draft, and I had something, and it wasn't really gelling for me. And because it was the Civil War, I was focusing on the South, which was the logical thing, right? What I realized was I asked myself, what was happening at the Canadian border? What was Canada, you know, which is always, I mean, it's 15 miles away. And that just blew everything up for me, because there's this whole history of the Confederacy and Canada that is completely unexplored.
Not now. Not through your fiction. The character of Mary Willis is memorable, to say the least. Would you read a portion of the book to give us an idea of her character?
Sure, of course. I'd love to. So this is after, soon after Mary's professor at Alfred has kind of started her on the path of helping fugitives along. With each fugitive she carried downtown, Mary felt as if she were sending something of herself into the world. She understood that there were dozens of others like her in the chain of barns and chicken shacks where each fugitive had sheltered, and in that, she felt some kinship, some belonging. She wished that there were some way she could send word back to each hand that had helped and let them know that they had been delivered, that their risks had not been in vain. But she could not, of course. She could know the previous stop, and she could know the next, but nothing more. The fugitives themselves were almost too much for her. They were suspicious of everything and everyone. The fear of their master back home and the pursuing hunters ran so deep in them that she struggled to fathom where they mustered the strength to run at all. Whenever she asked them about their trip, they would say as little as they could, instinctively protecting their protectors. As the same caution worked in her favor, she knew she should be grateful, but she longed to know more. She could not deny that she enjoyed the secrecy of it all, though.
Mary Willis's belief in humanity could not be farther removed from Scarlett O'Hara's attitudes. But they share a quality of fierce independence that was very rare for that time period. I wondered if you had that in mind when I read the passage on page 160, where Mary's in despair, kneeling in the snow, and then something becomes very clear to her, and I'm quoting, "She pulled her hair into place, straightened her back, and turned back to the house, knowing her way forward for the first time in months." Darren, is that your response to Scarlett's "As God is my witness" soliloquy?
You know, it certainly reads that way. Maybe it was, but I didn't do that consciously. I'll tell you that. I had an homage to Scarlett at one point in the book, but it didn't make the cut. At one point, I had actually lifted the physical description of Scarlett O'Hara from the book and put it in there, but I ended up cutting the character's appearance out. Largely, she shows up at one point, but you wouldn't know her from there.
17-inch waist and all. Yeah. Smallest in three counties.
I think it was a description of her face. The green eyes and the eye, but I can't remember.
If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Darren Wong. His debut novel is The Hidden Light of Northern Fire. It launches at the Decatur Book Festival this weekend. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment here on 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Kindred Healthcare. Gentiva Home Health and Hospice are now part of the Kindred family. Registered nurses are available to answer healthcare questions at 1-866-KINDRED. Caring for patients, honoring life. And from Emory Schwartz Center for Performing Arts. Presenting The Yellow Ticket, the rarely seen 1918 film, accompanied live with the original score by violinist Alicia Svigals. Thursday, September 7th at 8 p.m. arts.emory.edu.
We're back with City Lights here on WABE Atlanta. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to continue my conversation with Darren Wong, co-founder of the AJC Decatur Book Festival and author of the novel The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. All of the characters are richly drawn. Would you give us a thumbnail sketch of Nathan, Joe, and Leander, Mary's brother?
So I'll do my best. So Nathan is... You know, Nathan's where it all starts. Nathan's Mary's father, and he came west from Vermont in 1811. He's a settler, right? He's a pioneer, and you know there weren't a lot of people around at that time. And kind of one of the hidden backstory is this progression from nowhere to being in the middle of somewhere throughout the book. So Nathan is The real Nathan Willis, the historical character, his father and his older brothers fought in the Revolutionary War. His uncles all did. He was born right around the time the Constitution was, you know, was signed, was ratified. He feels like an essence of America to me. So he's a kind of strong, independent, stern man who's widowed fairly young, left with to raise these two kids kind of in a changing pioneer landscape. But he's a county commissioner and he's very involved in politics and he's very he loves to work and he loves to farm and he loves to make things grow.
And he had a wonderful relationship with the tribe that inhabited that area.
So, you know, one of the things that happened in the research of this, I ended up going to this little house museum not far from this house that I'd grown up in. And I walk in and there's these two big display cases marked the Willis Collection. And they were all of these Indian artifacts that had been found on our farm in the first half of the 20th century that I didn't know about, right? So suddenly I have a sense that this place had not only, you know, did it have the history of the Willises, but it also had this place of this history of the Indians, the Haudenosaunee, and specifically they the oral history shows him hiring Haudenosaunee to work his sawmill. So it seemed important that relationship that would have been a big part of his life.
Joe is an extraordinary character. He's my favorite character, and those are some pretty likable characters you've got. He loves to read, and Henry David Thoreau's writing makes a profound impression on him. Would you talk about the significance of On Walden Pond in this book of yours?
Yeah, well, it is, you know, we think about Walden as you know, as a place of retreat for, you know, in our lives of privilege, I guess. You know, you think about you know, everything that intrudes in our life. There's the idea of going and having a place by the pond of peace and contemplation. There's something idealized about that. But if you're a fleeing slave, it would mean something completely different. The idea, I mean, that would be, there's another level of ideal there. There's peace and there's an idea of having something of your own and the idea of being away from everything that is in pursuit of you. So it Joe latches on to that as, you know, as his goal, in essence. You know, this is what if you can't imagine what's next for you, and then you read that description, it becomes lodged in your mind as the thing.
How does writing, the act of writing, become Joe's salvation?
It's, you know, because Joe is injured. I mean, in the, you know, the very first pages of the book, and he ends up convalescing in one way or the other, and ends up in prison as well for quite a while. And that's, you know, it's his way forward. It's in essence, it's his, it's how he becomes, he recreates himself in essence from a fleeing slave to something else, to a leader, and to really become, you know, to become a man in his own eyes, I think.
There are aspects of this story that are frighteningly familiar today. And the part that echoed the most for me was when Leander is in the barber shop and the barber gives his answer to what this war's about.
Yeah, that's true. That moment, you know, Leander's, he's on his way back toward Buffalo from being away for a long time, and he stops to get cleaned up before he presents himself at home for the first time in years. And the barber says, well, I wouldn't go downtown. There's a lot of storms are brewing, essentially, and it's around shipping up these folks from down south to take our jobs and to.
And I thought, oh my God, this is not only racism, but it's also anti-immigrant and too much that resonates for the present. But I loved that part for the chills it gave me. At the Decatur Book Festival event for this book, Darren, you will be in conversation with Charles Frazier, who won the National Book Award for Cold Mountain. Does that seem surreal?
How could it not? You know, and Natasha Trethewey is coming down and introducing me. I don't know. I don't know what to say to that.
Okay.
I really don't know what to say.
I guess.
I mean, it is surreal. It's astounding. I wrote part of this book on the desk that Charles wrote Cold Mountain. I wrote just about 500 words on it. I'm not sure how many made it into the final draft, but there's a little bit of, you know, I mean, Cold Mountain left a big impression on me as I was writing, and I don't think, I'm not going to claim that there's much in common, but I do. There are aspects of it that I was aiming for.
So, a former poet laureate of the United States and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Natasha Trethewey, is introducing you. Charles Frazier will be in conversation with you to read the blurbs. The endorsements of this book is like a who's who in literary America, Darren. Clearly, some of the association you had with the Decatur Book Festival helped you in the recognition of this book.
Well, more than that, the book festival allowed me to, you know, because some of the relationships I have allowed me to have people read this book in various forms and offer me advice that would cost a lot of money to get otherwise. You know, people have been generous that way to me, and it's. You know, I've never taken a writing class, but I've had a master class of advice from a lot of great writers over the years.
History lesson, suspense, espionage, adventure, and moments of great beauty are found throughout this book, Darren.
Wow, Lois.
Congratulations on your debut novel, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lois. I've been looking forward to talking to you about this book for years.
Darren Wong's debut novel is The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. He launches the book this Saturday at the Decatur Book Festival, where he will be in conversation with the best-selling author and winner of the National Book Award, Charles Frazier. That's Saturday at 1:45 in the sanctuary of First Baptist Church of Decatur. You are listening to City Lights.